My name is Clancy Immelsland, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Clancy.
I'm very glad to be here. That young man who read the traditions, where'd he go? As far as I'm concerned, you could have read the long form, because we need to hear him, I'll tell you. In fact, I'll pick up where he left off here. In my home group, the Pacific group in Los Angeles, we read them the long forms the second Wednesday of every month. There's 1,000 people there, and they need to hear them, and they're glad to hear them. I was a little surprised as he got into it, though. I thought certainly we ought to read them, but not at maybe some other meeting. But I really like him. I'm very glad to be here. I'm glad to be back in Naples. I've been coming to Naples at the last week of October for every year since 1970, staying at Bill's and Kay's house down on Golf Drive and with a bunch of guys from around the country who are known as the Knights of Humility because of their arrogance. There's only one humble knight, and I'm too humble to tell you who that is. But I really love Naples. I watched it grow, unfortunately, but it's a lovely city, and I'm glad to be back here, glad to be at this convention. I want to thank Joe and the committee for inviting me. I first talked at a Florida State A convention, I guess, 30 years ago over in Miami, and I remember how much I enjoyed that, and I enjoy being here. And this is really, I feel kind of ill at ease. It's been so much good entertainment. You kind of feel like you hate to spoil it by having an AA talk in the middle of it, you know. Maybe I can get these honeys out here. I like them. I wish one of them would collapse in my arms. They did a wonderful job, though. And I, last night, I mean, you know, today we got the star-studded stuff, and last night they had the medieval stuff, and I was watching Joe march around dressed like King Henry VIII, and Tomer was some kind of a knight, in some gown of some sort, and I noticed Joe kept his costume on and Tomer took his off by the end of the evening. I said, "Why is that, Tomer? I mean, what's wrong? Why are you changing?" He said, "Well, it's easy for Joe. Once a king, always a king, but once a knight is enough." Yeah. I really enjoyed the convention. I've joined the meetings. I've gone to the meetings. I enjoyed last night, Brian. I've heard many times. I always like to hear him talk. I certainly enjoyed Gay's presentation yesterday, Gay G, on the singleness of purpose, which again is something we need to hear. And unfortunately, most people who need to hear it don't go to the meeting. That's the trouble with those kind of meetings. The singleness of purpose. Hell, I don't go there. And really, you really find out what A is about in those kind of meetings. And she does a remarkably good job. And those of us that were there enjoyed it very much. And I, of course, our Al-Anon speaker this afternoon, who is one of my... That's all I have to say about that. One of my very favorite... She's the only Al-Anon speaker I know of that I recommend people go in here. And I mean, I don't go myself, but I recommend a lot of people. She gives a very excellent talk. Nice girl. And it's been a good, all the small meetings have been good. It's been just a good, very fine moment of AA history. And it's good to look around, see all these people and outside there. Can you people in the back understand me at all? Because I haven't been able to understand anybody.
Can you understand me now?
That's the secret. It's an amazing thing. I know we have some new people. Some of them are reading here, and it's a nice thing to see that. And it's hard to remember that you look around the room, and I was walking around the hotel today and thinking, I'd like to find some newcomer and say, look at all these people, all doing so well, all casual, and try to imagine every one of them sick, and the men unshaven and the women smelling bad and dirty and drinking and drunk and sick. And think everyone here has been like that. And what a miracle it is for us to be here. And it's so hard to remember that. It's so easy to take this for granted. Because, you know, that's the bad thing about AA talks. You know how they're going to turn out. Sooner or later, no matter how sad I make this story, here I'm going to say, And then I put the plug in the jug. It's just been wonderful ever since. AA would be a lot more realistic at the group level if we'd have speakers every so often say, and then it turned out, God damn it, I just couldn't make it. You'd listen a little more closely to watch, is this going to be one who makes it or not, you know? Because that's the way it is in the groups. It's a funny thing, we talk a lot about AA and how easy it is, and it is so easy, there's really nothing to it. And that's why it's so strange that so many people slip and have such a hard time with it. I was in and out of AA year after year after year after year, and I don't like pain, and I hate being treated like a goof, and I hate to go back to those meetings and say, oh, that jerk is back again. I hate these things. I don't like pain, and yet I keep slipping. And it just seemed as though I wasn't one of the ones God chose. And I suppose the main reason was because I felt like I was a bad man and a sinner. And I'd hear people say, well, I'm sober through God's grace. And when they say that, I know that I'm not going to stay sober because I'm not going to get God's grace. God's grace goes to good people. It doesn't go to bad people. And I sometimes could stay sober in AA until I got talking about returning to God. And that was the beginning of the end. I can't do that. So I only have one problem with Alcoholics Anonymous. I never could identify. You know, the new people here tonight, I say, you know what an alcoholic is? Alcoholic is a person whose problem is alcohol. And you come to AA and admit your problem is alcohol. Then you return to God. And then after you get a new life, you show your gratitude by helping others. And I can't do any of those things because my problem really isn't alcohol. And I can't return to God because if God exists, I am damned. There's no way around that. And there's no way I'm going to stay around here. You know, many years ago, 1950s, right after they started the Grapevine, Dr. Silkworth, a famous man in AA history, not in AA, but Bill Wilson's doctor, wrote an article for the Grapevine discussing slips. He said, I don't know why alcoholics make such a big fuss about slips, as though there's some sort of supernatural thing or God coming down to punish bad people. He said, we see this in medicine all the time. He said, we have someone who has a severe heart attack, and we pull them through the heart attack, and we get them on their feet again. And we give them a regime to follow, a regime of you must get your rest, and you must watch what you eat, and you have to take certain exercises, and you take these medications, and they stay fine. But after a while, it gets boring, and they start making little alterations. And pretty soon, well, I don't need all that rest, certainly, after all this time. And I don't, you know, I can have a little thing to eat, and little by little. And they don't ever go over here. They just go off a little bit, but they keep going off a little bit. And one day they're over here, and they have another heart attack and sometimes die. So it's the same thing with diabetics. We see it all the time. Diabetics, we get them on their feet again. They're recovered. You can't have sugar. You must take your insulin. Take this diet. Get your rest. And they do just wonderfully. Till after a while, it gets a little boring. And I can't believe a little sugar thing would hurt me. And I don't really need all. I'll get more rest next week. I'll just, you know, and on. One day they're over here, and down they go. So that's all that ever happens to alcoholics. Nobody ever went over there to get drunk. You just, I don't need all this stuff. And little by little, you're over there and you're gone. He said, don't make a big deal out of it. It's just human nature. And it really, I can understand that so well in looking back in retrospect. I grew up and I was raised in a very strict religious family up in northern Wisconsin, Norwegian Lutherans. You don't see many Norwegian Lutherans in Florida or anywhere else. A few years ago, I was speaking in Oslo. And after the meeting, they took me up to north of there to a place called Gudbrandsdalen, where my grandfather had come from in the 1880s. A whole bunch of them came to America. My grandfather and his brothers and all kinds of people came to America in a big mob to get out of that damn climate. And they all settled in Wisconsin and Minnesota and spent the rest of their life saying, Jesus is cold here too. Yeah. When I grew up, and they brought their Norwegian Lutheran church with them. I thought that was kind of funny. When I went to Norway, the Norwegian Lutheran church in Norway is much more liberal than it is in Wisconsin. Because They didn't watch it liberalized. They kept it the way they remembered it in 1885 as much as they could. And you just have, it is like 10 commandments. You try to observe the 10 commandments. You don't sin, and you stay away from Catholics. You know, which seems reasonable. And when I wasn't a bad kid. I just seemed to need more fun than other Lutherans. And by the time I was 8 or 9, I'd broken a couple commandments. A couple of days I forgot to honor my mother and my father, and I coveted my neighbor or something. And little bit, by the time I was 12, I'd done some more evil things. By the time I was 15, I knew that I was damned. And I didn't want to be, but I just can't do it. And what saved me is that the war started, and I ran away to the war. And But I always had that secret knowledge, I'm really going to go to hell. You know, you say, well, you grow up, you get over that. But like Hitler said, you give me their minds till they're 12, and they'll be a little bit of Nazis when they're 95. And so I was having trouble in school. I was having some trouble with life, and I was small and skinny. I had a bunch of pimples, and the war starts. I thought, I'll go to the war, and I'll go to kill Japs. And I decided, my mother gave me, I was going to tell her I want to go to Superior, Wisconsin, to visit my aunt. She packed my little bag and gave me bus fare, and I took that and hitchhiked to San Francisco. Had no idea where the hell I was going. Got one ride all the way, or I never would have made it. And I told this guy, I want to be in the Marine Corps and kill Japs. He said, you're a little small. This guy tried to be in the Navy going back to a ship. He said, you can't get in the Marine Corps, but you might get in the Merchant Marine. They're really crying for men. They really need, anybody that'll breathe, they'll take. And he said, he showed me how to go to the Coast Guard office, and I went there in San Francisco. I said, you're only 16. I lied my age. He said, you're only 16. You have to have your parents' permission. So I took it around the block, got my parents' permission. And they gave me Seaman's papers right there. And the guy took me to the National Maritime Union, and I signed a waiver for my dues, whatever they were. And a guy took me to the Embarcadero and put me on a big ship. And an hour later, I was on my way to the South Pacific. And it really was fun for about 45 minutes. You know. But it's these tough guys. And I was stuck in they called it a cabin, but cabins have logs. This was a room with three of the worst type of people that any small, skinny, pimply-faced, dumb kid can be with. These guys are called men. What the hell are you supposed to be, kid? And I lay in my bunk, and these guys start talking, and I never heard talk like that. I was in a room with big-time sinners. I thought I'd been a sinner. These were big-time sinners. They'd been doing dirty things with girls in that San Francisco for days, apparently. I'd had sex in Eau Claire, Wisconsin at 15, but I'd been apprehensive and I'd been afraid and I'd been alone. And these guys were doing it with people. And I studied them for a while. Of course, they've all got black hair. Those are the Catholics I've heard about. But I found a niche on that ship. I became the ship fool, after a while. Hey, kid, go up to the downtown. We need left-handed wrench. Hey, kid, go up to the bridge. Tell the captain we need some elbow grease. And these guys all had whiskey in their sea bags, and they'd drink every night and drink when they got off watch. And it just appalled me because I'd never seen anything like that. And they'd drink and curse and talk dirty, and I just felt so bad. And one day this guy turned to me and said, how about you, Junior? You think you're man enough for a little snort? And he shoved that bottle in my face, and I was dumb, but I was basically a Norwegian Lutheran, despite being a bad one. And I just was developing something to tell him that just demolished him. I was going to say, you big bad man, get that bottle out of my face. I happen to be a Norwegian Lutheran. We don't drink whiskey. And even if we did, I promised my mother and grandmother I'm not going to drink whiskey, and don't you ever do that again. I may be small, but I got some honesty. I was just going to tell him that. He said, why do you think you're man enough? And I heard a voice say, goddamn right. So I had my first drink out of the first bottle I was close to, and I threw up, and they laughed at me. And all the way across the Central Pacific, where nobody's looking, I'd sneak in that guy's sea bag sooner or later, another one, and take a drink. And I'd vomit it, and I'd wipe it up, and so they didn't know. I was so desperate. I wanted those guys to think I was a man. I could hold a drink down, and I never could. And we were coming into Pearl Harbor, finally. I saw that movie Pearl Harbor last year. It was a terrible love story, but it really had, they had recreated it. That's the way Pearl Harbor looked at the beginning of World War II. And everybody's up there looking. I was down there taking a drink of this slop one more time. And the day before my 16th birthday, it stayed down, and I couldn't breathe. And all of a sudden, something strange happened. I found myself feeling significantly better. It's great. I realized why people drink. I didn't. In your teens, you learn things. You don't pay much attention to them. Everybody in that ship smoked. Nobody in my family smoked. They smoked. So I smoked and puked and smoked and puked. One day I smoked and didn't puke, and I smoked 2.5 or 3 packs a day every day for the next 40-some years. I learned to curse a little bit on that ship. I learned techniques for lust. None of them ever worked, but I had at least a starting point. And I didn't become a terrible alcoholic. The next day they took me to Honolulu and bought me 4 bottles of beer, and I got drunk, and they laughed, and I laughed, and it was funny. That's all. No big deal. I went another ship to the Aleutian Islands after that, and I look back, and I really liked to drink. I tried to learn to drink from then on, to drink things that wouldn't make me sick. Because what I found out as a teenager, that drinking gave me a good feeling. I didn't know what it was. In retrospect, I think what it was so significant. I believe I would describe it as, that was the first time I ever felt the way men looked. And it was just a remarkable thing. Holes in me were filled up. And many years later, standing on Skid Row in Los Angeles, with my teeth kicked out and everything I had gone after being somewhat successful, if someone asked me why I drank alcohol, I could give them all sorts of reasons. Based on my psychoanalysis, I'd spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis. I read books. I read German philosophy. I did a lot of things. And I could give you reasons why, of the conflicts and inner conflicts in my being. But in looking back, the one answer I wouldn't have given because I wouldn't have understood it was the correct answer. But the correct answer was, I had my last drink because it made me feel the way men look. That's about the only thing I can describe it. I remember the last day I drank, some many years later, 2 big guys threw me out of a Skid Row mission. I landed outside on the sidewalk. And I stood there in the rain, a cold, rainy morning, sick and desperate. Terrible feeling. I didn't know what the feeling was. I know what it is now because I've seen it in others. And I'm sure there are people in this room who've had it. A feeling, there is no friendly direction. You have no more friendly. There's no place to withdraw to go back to say, I'm sorry. You are on your own, pal. You better make it. If some old guy would have come up to me that morning and said, you know, Slim, you're dying. You're down to 120-some pounds. You've lost your wife and children. You'll never see them again. You've lost your career. Once upon a time, they called you a boy genius. Now you can't even get a job washing dishes. You've lost all your clothes in that car you're driving for someone that you lost in Phoenix. Then you went to jail in Phoenix. That's where the guy kicked your front teeth out. So now you're standing here with your blood dripping down your mouth, and you're sick and bloated and got no clothes. Your clothes are torn and covered with vomit. Your little mother up in Wisconsin, she's no longer allowed to accept phone calls from you because your stepfather's so tired of watching you call her and manipulate her so she'll go to her little tiny bank account and send a few more dollars and try to help her little boy. Now, you're dying on the street. Now, you've been going to AA off and on for almost 10 years now. And you sit in these meetings smugly even now and think these idiots and their little problems. Why don't you go back to AA one more time and admit you're an alcoholic? And do something about it. And if some guy had said that to me, and if I were in a mood to be honest, which I probably would not have been, I'd have had to tell him, pal, you don't understand. I'm not really an alcoholic. And he might have said, well, prove you're not an alcoholic. I wouldn't have been able to do that because I wouldn't have been able to stand back and delineate the differences. So I probably would have done what people like me do when we get cornered and we're afraid. I take refuge behind bluster. And I say things like, oh, get out of my face, you son of a bitch. Leave me alone. Get away from me. Because I'm afraid, and I don't want them to know I'm afraid. I can look back now and really understand a little bit more about that situation. I mean, I knew I had problems. I've had no problems since I was a little boy. I've always had the feeling, I guess, I didn't know what the feeling was until I would look at it later in life. But I've always had the feeling there's something missing in me, and I don't know what it is, and nobody tells me. But I know when I get close to people, they act as though there's something missing in me because they don't seem to accept me the way they accept other people. And I don't seem to fit into places like I want to fit into, like other people seem to fit into. And I feel different. I feel lonely sometimes. And I get in the middle of crowds where you shouldn't feel lonely. And I feel less than sometimes. I feel superior sometimes. But I don't feel equal to anybody. I feel not a part of things. And not all of these things aren't there all of the time, but they come and go like bubbles in a pot. And I really hate that feeling. I thought when I grow up, I'll outgrow it. But I didn't outgrow it. I had some victories along the way. I had some victories along the way. It was fine, but the victories don't ever seem to last because they just seem to last a day, and then now what you're going to do to prove yourself? Always got to prove myself. Always got to prove something. I don't know to whom or for what about. And I, when I got older, I became somewhat successful as a writer. And when I had some money and wanted to do something about it, I got into psychoanalysis. And I really got to like psychoanalysis. I spent thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and I don't know why I liked it. Because all you ever hear in psychoanalysis is news on how you've been hurt in ways you don't remember. You know. But I really liked it. I used to go out there and think, Jesus, it's a sad story, but I'm doing pretty well. And I never understood why psychoanalysis helped people like me. I don't know, until years later, when I was sober quite a while, a few years ago, a guy that I sponsor was telling me how much help he was getting by going to adult children of alcoholics. Not the Al-Anon version, but the other version. He said, "Do you want to go to a couple of meetings?" I said, "Sure, I'd love to go." And I sat there, and I watched this action going on, and I suddenly realized that's what psychoanalysis did for me. It really helped me. Of all the emotions I know, probably the worst one is deep-seated guilt. Continual, perpetual guilt. You don't always recognize it, but there's always that ball in your stomach. And not only guilt of the things you've done, but guilt of the things you should have done and didn't do, and it's too late now. And you go through life, it seems to me, if you're supposed to feel like this, it's always like this, just always off somehow. And what would you think? I don't know of any way to get rid of guilt. Drinking gets rid of it temporarily, gets rid of that scale at least. But what did you think of a therapy that gets rid of guilt? And that's what psychoanalysis did for me. Whether it intended to work that way or not, I don't know. And I don't know whether Adult Children of Alcoholics Anonymous is supposed to work this way. But it worked this way for me. It just boils down to this. It works on the principle that the patient is and has always been a victim. You've been hurt a great deal. It's not your fault. You've not received the love you needed. You have not received the nurturing, the friendly hands that should have been there, and on and on. As you get that little by little, you come to realize, yes, I was hurt a lot. And little by little, you come to realize it really wasn't my fault. I've been made this way by forces beyond my control. And little by little, guilt slowly dissipates. And it's great, although I never thought of guilt dissipating. I just thought I'm feeling better. But in looking back, I can see that's what it does. Guilt dissipates. There's a great relief that hadn't come for years. He said, "What's wrong with that? That's a great thing." And maybe it is for most people. But you know, you'll discover anything that you find good in this world, there's always a little price tag for it, a little tag attached to it. And there are three little price tags for victimization that you don't see at the time, but you can see them in retrospect clearly. One, whether you intend to or not, you must accept and enhance feelings of resentment. Resentment toward the people who have hurt you. Resentment towards the people who have failed you. You go to those meetings, boy, and there's no laughter in those meetings. They are intense meetings of people talking about how they've been hurt. And the second little price tag you pay is you must accept the fact that you have been made irrevocably different. That you're different, you're going to stay different. I didn't really understand that. I heard one of their gurus talk one time. He said, "We were like trees. When we were saplings, someone reached within us and pulled out our hearts. We continue to grow physically. We look like all other trees. But we have no heart and we have no soul because it's been taken from us." And of course, the third little price tag you pay, which is obvious if you're like me, intermittent but intense self-pity. I could have been something by God. You know, I was thinking of that scene in On the Waterfront where Marlon Brando says to his brother, I could have been a contender, Jimmy, if you'd have taken care of me. And I said, well, what's wrong with that? These are inconveniences, but to get rid of guilt, maybe they're all right. And maybe they are for most people. But after I was here a while sober and beginning to understand that and reading this book and starting to understand AA, I ran across something funny in this book. This book lists the three most lethal emotions for people like me. Resentment, self-pity, and feelings of difference. And why are they so lethal? Because they will justify every drink I take till I die from it. And it will never have been my fault. And you don't understand. And those are the words of people who drink till they die. But I read philosophy. I did a lot of things. I got into German philosophy, which is just impossible to understand. It's just backwards and upside down. And when you're reading it by yourself, you go, huh? But when people are looking, you say, how true. I did a lot of things. But nothing in my life ever helped me as much as a few drinks. I didn't have any understanding that it was an unnatural effect. I just thought, a few drinks helps me with anything. And I love drinking. Drinking makes me feel, drinking gets rid of that scale. Drinking makes me feel like I'm something. And what's wrong with that? I just have one problem with it. I have an unfortunate tendency to overdrink sometimes. Or as I prefer to believe, I have many times been thoughtlessly overserved. And then I act bizarrely. And a psychiatrist told me once, you act bizarrely because you were repressed as a child by the Norwegian Lutheran Church, and you're now just breaking forth. I told an arresting policeman that one night. He didn't even care. I go to jail. No big deal. When I get drunk, I act badly. So I was sent to my first AA meeting. I wasn't sent there. Someone suggested that some of the town drunks seemed to be slowing down their drinking. Maybe I ought to go there and see what they're doing. I went to my first drinking meeting in 1949. That's a long time ago. A lot of you little snots weren't even born. We love you. And I don't know what I expected to find, but what I found wasn't anything that helped me. It seemed to me a bunch of eight old guys sitting around a table. Put the plug in the jug. Remember the term, what the hell are you supposed to be, kid? You think you're an alcoholic? I was 22. I said, no, I don't think I'm an alcoholic. What the hell do you think you're doing here? And I tried to be honest. I said, I think I'm too sensitive. I tell you, I never told anybody else that for a long time. If you're working with a newcomer and he says he's too sensitive, or she is, you might try not to laugh, because you may be trying to be honest for the first time in a long time. But I went to the meetings for a little while. I think the final meeting I went to really got me. The guy said, I stayed drunk around the clock for 20 years. One day I walked through that door. They told me to put the plug in the jug, and I did. And I've just never been so goddamn happy. But I went to work for Fairbanks Morse, the nearby city in their advertising department, and I got drinking a little too much, and I went to AA again, same old crap, just different faces, and went to AA again. And after a while, AA is a nice place except for one thing. My problem is not alcohol. I have some of the feelings they have, but my problem is alcohol. I can stop drinking anytime, and I have done it time after time. My problem is, once I stop, sometimes a couple days later, sometimes a week later, somebody sneaks into my bedroom in the middle of the night and puts an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning when I get up, they start to tighten it. And then just starts the restlessness and the irritability and the resentment of being treated like a child by people who are depending on me. And little by little, I get a little cross and I try to do things about it, but I know the only thing that will cut that feeling is two or three drinks. And I put it off as long as I can, and eventually I take a drink. But I don't take a drink because I'm a drinker. I don't know how to explain that to people. I drink because I have these feelings. And then sometimes later I drink too much again. And they say, oh, your problem is drinking. You ought to go to AA. You'll be all right. And you have to say, gee, thanks for the advice. But you just want to shriek, but you don't understand. Doesn't anybody understand? My problem is not that. There's something wrong inside of me. But I'll tell you one thing. You don't want to talk about it much. Because I don't want to, as our book says, no one wants to look very different from their fellows, I guess. And so I drank and stayed sober and went to psychoanalysis and read books and had jobs and good jobs and went down and had another good job and went down. Finally went down in Dallas. That was the last time I was working for Tracy Locke, the largest advertising agency in the South. And I was helping write these LC and Elmer ads for the Borden Company. And down I went, and in a matter of just a few days, I guess they'd been setting it up for some time. They'd notified my wife. She left. They repossessed my car. I was evicted from my house. I stood a week after I got working there. I was standing on the street corner with nothing. And I got a car to drive to Los Angeles to get out of there. And I got as far as Phoenix and got drunk and lost the car and got into jail and kicked my teeth out and lost everything I had and went over to the A Club and hustled some old lady for $20, told her I was a newcomer and for a 12-step hostel. I got that to Los Angeles, and here I'm being thrown out of a Skid Row mission. And stay out of here, you troublemaker. I tried to explain to him, I'm not a troublemaker. 3 years ago, I was on the faculty of the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote are running this weekend in Life and Time and the New Yorker and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for one of my achievements. But it's hard to explain these things in midair, you know. And I stood outside of that damn old mission in a cold rain. And that old guy didn't come up and talk to me, but I couldn't talk to him. But I knew I had to get out of the rain, and I was sick. And I have to get to an AA club and pretend to be a newcomer, at least till it stops raining. And I found out where an AA club was. It was 72 blocks away. And I walked and walked and walked in the rain and walked and walked and sick, my mouth bleeding, like drenched. And going to New York asked me one time, how could you possibly walk that far when you were so sick and desperate? And, of course, a number of people in the room know the answer to that. That's the only time you can. You would not ever do that if you had any alternative. And I got to this club and the same old crap and the steps and turned over to God and admit you're an alcoholic and sickening smirks and just... And I lurked there all day long. I had a meeting that night. I had about 4 pounds of cake that I could eat with my gums. And they had a meeting on gratitude and I almost puked it up again and just... And then they all went home, and I had no place to sleep. It was raining, and I said to the manager of the club, I tried to put on my newcomer look. I'm a newcomer, and I've lost everything. I have no place to stay. Can you help me? The Maybelline look. He said, you're in luck, kid. A guy named Joe Quinn left an old 49 Merc in the parking lot last summer. It's in the tall grass out there. You can sleep in that. I said, you want me to sleep in an abandoned car? He said, yeah, good deal, huh? Thank you very much. I still remember sleeping in that damn old car the night, cold and sick and my mouth bleeding. Got up, I thought, I can't believe this. And the next morning I went into the club and a Sunday morning, ate some more cake, and they had a spiritual meeting about God or Jesus or somebody I didn't want to hear about who was on my tail. And lurked all afternoon that night. There was another meeting, and I went to that and ate some more cake and listened to this crap and slept in my abandoned car and kept raining and got up the next morning. I remember thinking, maybe I'm dead. Maybe I'm dead. Maybe this is what hell really is. It isn't fire and brimstone. It's just cold and rain and your mouth hurts and every day someone talks to you about AA. For eternity. And I had no idea then or thereafter that would be my sobriety day. Didn't want it to be. I got sober a lot of times for good reasons. I never wanted it. I didn't want to be sober that. What's the purpose of staying sober? You know, you think, if a lot of people think, like I used to think, if you really want to stop drinking bad enough, you will. And maybe some people do, but not people of our type, apparently. I was in jail one night overnight, just overnight. I was in jail overnight a lot because I have a tendency when I drink to counsel police officers. You'd think you'd learn after a while, but I always think there's a new officer that needs help. And I got up in the morning, a guy met me, and He said, gee, you should have stayed home last night. I know. I'm sorry. It's going to be better. I just had it badly. He said, well, you're out drunk last night. Your little son died, and we couldn't find you anywhere. And that just about killed me, because I had a bunch of little girls and one little boy, and I could not stand it. I could not. I felt such a wave of terrible guilt. And we buried my little boy in Wisconsin. I still remember that weekend sitting in a living room with my two big brothers and all their big, healthy farmers, Wisconsin farm boys, and their dad, my father-in-law. And nobody said an unkind word to me. They just, have some more pastry, Clancy. Here, have some little coffee. And here, can I get you something? But in their eyes, you could just see, what have you done to our sister, you dirty bastard? You dirty bastard. Have some more pastry. And we buried my son. I put my hand in his casket. Nobody was watching. I said, I promise you, John Emmisland, this will never happen again in our family. I promise you. And we buried him the next day, and that was that. I'll tell you, I was thinking about this, talking to a newcomer the other day. He's having this problem. I didn't realize how guilty that made me feel. I was sober 5 years before I could face the fact that my son was dead, and I went back and put a gravestone on his grave. I could not. I just could never think about it. I got my father and my father-in-law, and we went down to this little country churchyard and put this little gravestone, our little boy, John. And it was really touching. It took me. I didn't realize what a deep thing that was. But I stopped drinking, and I went back to Texas where I was working, and I really had a feeling almost like it was Easter or something. Someone has died, but for a purpose to make us all better. And we got along fine, and my family and I got along fine. We prayed for John's soul, and I went to work and got along good at work, and things were going well. And I thought, it's so sad my son's death had to happen, but he did it so we could all live. And it was wonderful till one night somebody snuck into my bedroom and put an invisible spring in my gut. And the next morning it started. Just a little irritability. And the days went by in restlessness, now coupled with great self-pity. And God, killing my son because I'm bad. What kind of a rotten goddamn thing is that? Just, it was the job. I didn't like the job anymore. It's a bunch of dumbbells, and I didn't like Texas. I didn't like it. My daughters, they're noisy at night. Mary, take your sisters and go to your room. For God's sake, let me alone. And then hate myself. I'm sorry, girls. We'll play tomorrow. And knowing if I could just have a couple drinks, I could break it. But you're taking a vow in your son's casket. You can't take a couple drinks. And one day it got to a point where my wife took the children to church. I just pulled the car in the garage and hooked a hose on the exhaust pipe. And during the morning, went to sleep and died. And a neighbor happened to be sitting drinking coffee in his den, and he noticed that I went in there and heard the motor run. I didn't come out, so he ambled over to see what was wrong, and he found me dead in the car. They pulled me out and beat at my chest and breathed my mouth, and they rushed me to the hospital and examined me for a week and determined I was seriously mentally ill and committed me to the state insane asylum. Now, that's how I get when I stop drinking, folks. That is not a drinking problem. There's something terribly wrong inside of me. They classified me as a schizophrenic.